Welcome back to DMnastics, the gym for dungeon masters to work out their minds. I'm one of your hosts, DM Neil, aka Jote Maniac.
And I'm your other host, DM Celeste, aka Sea Witch.
And today, we're going to cover it all.
Cover it all? Is that a bad pun for the name of this episode?
It is! Yes.
I'm so surprised.
Nah, shocking. So for today's superset, we are going, like I said, going to listen to an oldie but a goodie. Get it? Also because it's
also
old.
Because
we're calling it Cover It All. And on this episode, the guest was Morgan Jenkins, a wonderful human being who helped talk through taking old album covers and letting those inspire RPG items, topics.
Ooh, yeah. Very cool.
Yes, I at some point have even been further inspired to create a series of blog posts and fifth edition items with a series called LP to RP.
Yes, there are so many cool metal covers out there that make it perfect. So I'm excited to hear this episode.
Yes, very, very easy to do.
But with that, let's get to the exercise already in progress.
So we have a collection of album covers with the band names and titles removed. So you don't really get an idea from that what the pictures are. So, for instance, this first one, if it was called Return to Skull Island, which would be a strange name for an album, but fine, then you'd be like, okay, there's an island and it's a skull and this strange mermaid man thing is returning to it with his strange sword and horn and all the rest of it. But we've taken that away, so you wouldn't know that, and you'd have to come up with your own thing, hopefully better than what I did. And that's what a lot of people on the forums did.
Exactly. Yeah, so for the first one we have, it was done by DM Kiato. So he chose an album cover that essentially has three barbarians battling it out, and it was from the band Dust on the album Hard Attack.
Which I had never heard before, and I'm currently listening to pretty much right now. It's fantastic.
And it was by the artist Frank Frazetta, and the title was Snow Giants.
Snow Giants. Well, there we go. Right there you can see that it's we've moved away from the giants in the snow somewhat, and we've headed towards barbarians, which is quite fun. And of course, if you want to see all the art, you can go to dungeonmasterblock.freeforums.net. And find the DMnastics 31.
Yes.
To have a look at them all, because there are some fantastic bits of artwork there that we're probably not going to be covering all of them here today.
No, but another tip / trick that you want to do when you get there is, first off, don't use Internet Explorer, because you shouldn't. Microsoft doesn't even want it. But you should right-click and search Google for image. At that point, it'll bring up the image. You'll be able to find the artist. You can find where it came from, but also finding that artist is going to give you more inspiration. If they're willing to spend the time to make one that you can draw fantasy from, they'll be willing to make more. By doing that, I also realized that that same artist, Frank Frazetta, made another one that's on this list. Definitely check all of the images out to find who did them and if they did more awesome stuff. But enough of all that. We will now talk about the barbarians of Northfell.
Specifically, the Northfell clans and Ragnar's kin.
Yeah, DM Kiato obviously saw these three dudes duking it out and thought, they have to be barbarians. Who's dumb enough to fight with that little clothing in the snow? So yeah, the barbarians of Northfell live and die in the frozen north, following the migrations of great beasts that provide them with everything from food and clothing to insulation. And your classic barbarians, if you will, who live and die by the land. And they're divided into family clans that often war with each other and consider battle to be the greatest test of a man. Often use battle to settle their differences. The shamans guide them spiritually for the god, and he said, yet to be determined. And obviously we probably pick something back from the pantheon, which would be the pantheon for Deimbe, because that's how everything works now.
Snap, it's almost like we designed it.
So the veil is lifting. So yeah, the clan leaders are the strongest, boldest clan members, and the family lineage has nothing to do with it. It doesn't matter who beget who. As long as you're the strongest one, you are the leader. So once a summer, they gather at Ragnar's Hold to commemorate Ragnar Stormhammer leading them from the Great Blight and into the north, from which all clans can trace back their originating event and all differences are put aside for a week celebration.
Nice. Although I'm sure, because they're barbarians, this celebration would involve some fighting.
You know, yes.
Instead of actively trying to kill each other, it's just some playful beating each other to death.
Yes.
He was just in funsies.
It's only blood light. That's fine. Then the last piece he put was that once in a great while, Ragnar Reborn will rise from their ranks and combine all the tribes on a warpath in honor of some tradition, perceived slight, or the will of their god.
Now, that's interesting to me because I feel like Ragnar Reborn, you could go different ways with this. You could say Ragnar Reborn is genuinely, it's Ragnar, you know, come back to this world to join us all together and to lead us. Or you could go the route of, it's just a guy that reckons he's so awesome, he can beat us all into submission and bend us all to his will. And then where we say, oh, he's Ragnar Reborn. He's not actually Ragnar Reborn, but he's got that same level of spirit and will and determination and vision to guide all of the clans, you know, unite them and take them in this one direction until ultimately, presumably, once that's complete, factions start to appear and everything breaks apart again. And I personally, I like going in that direction more, of this idea of sort of a title almost, once someone has enough vision, because then you can have people that attempt to be Ragnar Reborn and they get some of the clans behind them, but not all of them. And that could potentially lead to some interesting inter-clan conflict that players could then walk into.
Yes, I like it. I like that one a lot more, because I was going to say, just like you did right there, there's a lot more RP behind the idea that it's the man becoming the legend rather than him, the legend becoming a man. And then he's just destined to do it if he's just Ragnar Reborn, but rather, you know, like the clans whispering of his deeds, like, you know, is this Ragnar Reborn? And the only actual proof is if this person is successful in uniting all the clans together for some cause.
Although that could work quite well if it genuinely is Ragnar Reborn. I mean, you think of the number of sort of, back in my day, we did things differently, you know. Ragnar could become reborn in a young child and grow up within this world, and it's been hundreds of thousands of years since the last time he was around, and things are completely different. And he could say, well, I challenge you to a game of stick hoop. They're like, what? He's like, that's how we settled it. That's how I united everyone, was stick hoop. They're like, no, we beat each other to death. He's like, well, I'm 12. I don't want to do that.
I'm so terrible.
Go away, you idiot.
But I am a stick hoop prodigy, though.
I feel like you could enter into this interesting situation where the players come across Ragnar and he's been reborn, and it's just everyone sitting around waiting for Ragnar to come back, and he's taken one look at the state of things and gone, you know what, I'm just happy not. I'll just sit over here. And they discover this and they're like, hey, aren't you Ragnar? He's like, shush, 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 don't tell everyone. They'll expect things from me.
I like it. He's like, no, I'll get it next reincarnation, not this one.
I'm taking this one off.
Yeah, I'm going to sit this one out, guys.
So it'd be interesting to play with, you know, both sides of that coin. Personally, I think I would lean towards the former, leaning towards it being a sort of a title based on the legend rather than being a genuine reincarnation. But we'll see how that goes. The world's so vast and complex, you could probably actually go with both.
Oh, that would be an interesting, yeah, like if it hadn't really happened before, because, I mean, you have these clans and like each clan believes one thing, like, no, this is, he's just gonna be born again, and then other clans are like, no, he has to essentially transcend into that title. I like it.
You could have warring Ragnars, and one's like, well, I'm actually Ragnar, and the other one's like, well, I've got more done under your name like everyone else has before you. So, well, that'd be interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, fun.
Cool. Well, I think that'll do it for that one. If we want to move on to the next one, This one was taken by Friar Took.
Friar Took.
Yes. And I'm not going to tell you what it was called, but it was done by John Dyer Baisley.
Baisley. That's a last name.
And so he's a painter and musician. So he's done the album covers for a ton of different bands. And two of them made it onto this list. And there's, again, Google image search, look up John Dyer Baisley, do whatever. And he has a ton of great fantasy style art. But I will let Morgan tell us about this one because he got super excited when we read it.
I did. I thoroughly enjoyed it. And the image, just to give you a quick description, and of course, again, you can go to the forums and see it yourself. It's this wonderful, it looks like almost a wreath of pine cones being held up by this young woman who has blotches and spots on her arms and face, and she's covering her eyes. And in the top left-hand corner, there are big dark storm clouds. And in the bottom left-hand corner, there are these what look like corn or wheat. I think wheat, and they're bending, these wheat stalks are bending, and then there are some bees and some bones in a halo around her head and actually through her hair. And it's bizarre imagery. And I think what Friar Tuck has done with it is very interesting because he's created this idea of the plague witch. Rumor has it that deep in the swamps of the Eastern Delta, the plague witch makes her home. She draws her power from the slow decay and corruption of life. It is said she was once a powerful priestess and healer on a path to becoming head of her order. So right there, just out the gate, we've got this fantastic idea of here's the just darkest thing in the world, and it came from the lightest thing. And now let's talk about how this happened, which I just dig that opening. So yes. Weeks before she was to be anointed the High Healer, she met the love of her life. A great hunter, trapper, and woodsman who was charged with defending the borders of their land from the horror that came out of the swamps of the Eastern Delta. Okay, what is the horror from this swamp? Perhaps it was Doug the Kraken. We will never know.
You can see an image of Doug the Kraken above. Doug is...
So much bigger than we thought. We were looking at that image and thinking, oh, you're looking down from the top of a cliff at him. And then partway through, I think you were like, that tiny little speck there is a lighthouse. Mm. We realized he was much larger than we thought. Terrifying. But no,
Doug the Kraken, done grown up, man. Done grown up.
Hashtag Dougspiracy. So as the High Healer is sworn to never have a lover, she's supposed to love all equally, nor bear children, all the peoples of the world are to be as children to her, the priestess declined the position of High Healer and left the order. To live in happiness with her lover in his home at the edge of the Eastern Delta. Within months, she was pregnant, and all was well for her in life. And that's the end of the story. Nothing terrible happened after that. Nope. Just, that's it. Now she lived happily. Right?
Yep.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Good. Okay. Oh, until the day her lover returned from a scouting foray with a deadly wound. He'd been attacked by a horrible lizard beast, and it's bitten off one arm. Wow. And the creature's venom caused the wounds to rot. So she sought aid in her faith, but she'd left the order and not practiced in some time. All her attempts to heal the wounds failed. All her prayers went unanswered. So as you do, when you pray once or twice and you're like, to my chosen deity, will you heal this? And you get no answer, straight up turn to the dark arts. Harry Potter has taught me that one thing. So... her schooling and preparation for the post of High Healer had brought much knowledge of these forbidden arts, as you do. Secret teachings in which the healing essence of life is twisted and corrupted, but she was desperate. Her lover was dying and there was nothing she could do. So she made a terrible choice. She knew of a ritual through which the life essence of an unborn child could be channeled into a living creature, restoring and revitalizing it. Basically, she convinced herself that she had no choice. She would sacrifice her unborn child for the life of her lover, which is pretty drastic.
Yep, to say the least. You can see drastic things like that on our hear drastic things like that on our Dilemmas podcast.
Yes. Oh, no, those were terrible, weren't they?
Mm-hmm.
The idea of, you know, do you sacrifice many, many people for your child, or do you sacrifice the child for the people?
Yes.
Things like that, and working that kind of choice into the game. After all, and this is interesting, it's that idea of, you know, going from emotion versus reasoning. Emotion says, my child comes first because my child, this thing that I created. Reason says, and here she's gone with reason, which is very interesting. And if she was going to be a high priestess, that makes sense because she would have come mm-hmm. from this idea of empathy, yes, but also reason and almost triage. And so in this instance, she does become almost like triage. And she goes, you know what? If he lives, we can kindle a new life and we can have more children, many, many children in time. And of course, if you're, I'm assuming Dayembe being a fantasy world, sort of medieval style fantasy world, there would be potentially quite a high infant mortality rate. So even if she had this child, it may not survive. Mm-hmm. So she performs this ritual and dark phantoms visit the hut, and then she births this sort of child, but it's all of a sudden, instead of it being a single child, it's many children, and they're grubs and worms and beetles and flies, and they just gush forth in a foul stream and swarm over the body of her love, and they burrow into his wounds and crawl under his skin, and his eyes open, and they are black and yellow as of dead things, and they still live there in the darkness of the Delta swamps. No longer do they seek to defend the kingdom from the beasts and monsters of the swamps. Instead, they and their many, many children are the beasts and the monsters, which I just think is so sad and brutal. And I feel like it provides so much of an opening for a story if you've got people that need to go to the Delta swamps, go into the swamps and fetch something, fetch, you know, whether it's they need to fetch a flower from the healer's crown or fetch, you know, a pine cone from the wreath that she carries in remembrance.
Yeah, some artifact that she took with her when she left the order.
And you can also, you get to play with the idea of sort of story and of fantasy, of fairy almost, you know, that crossing the threshold into this area, into the Delta swamps. And the word I'm looking for that I can't think of right now, it's like fantasy, but it's not, it's stories. When you hear fairy tales, there we go, my brain. It's a fairy tale. And you can either, you can play it as this is a thing that has recently just happened and it's still real and it still exists and we still believe it. Or you fast forward, you know, like the White Walkers, those that don't live near the wall believe them to be fairy tales. Those that live near the wall think of them as other, you know. And this could be something like that, where you have an idea of the plague witch, you know, these stories that we tell our children, for we live near the Delta swamps and we don't want them to go into the swamps because we don't want them to drown. We don't want them to get bitten by a bug because they might catch malaria and die, or fantasy malaria. And so we say, if you go into the swamps, the plague witch will get you. And so these are fairy tales. But as with all fairy tales, there could potentially be a kernel of truth in there. So then you get to decide, well, in your game that you're running, is the kernel of truth this story that has been put together by Friar Took? And then the fairy tale around this story is something bigger or darker or stranger or just different. So that when they then come across the plague witch, and the plague witch says, no, I don't have a gingerbread house and I don't bake children over a fire. I gave birth to my children after sacrificing my real child. And, you know, and then as you fight or as you interact with her, this story here comes out and you get the real dark, terrible story. And all you've been told are the lighter sort of fairy tales. Or is this the fairy tale in your sort of your, instead of Hans Christian Andersen lighter, this is the Brothers Grimm version. This is the dark, dark fairy tale. And the reality is actually something else, either something worse or possibly something better, you know, something less. You know, she's just a witch and she lost her child and then she left. She left. And she left the order and went and lived with this man. You know, they set up a couple of traps because he's a hunter, and maybe someone got caught in one of those traps, and then they came back with stories of all the creature, terrible creatures and things, because they didn't want to say, I was an idiot and stepped in a trap. So, you know, that's where this fairy tale came from, and maybe he saw something in the forest that had yellow eyes, and he was like, oh, it was the hunter, and he's evil now. And again, you could decide to go either way and say, you know, this is the reality or this is the fairy tale. And there's a lot of room to play with that idea. Where would you take that, do you think, Neil?
I think a really good idea, though, would be to make sure that you try and incorporate things like this into your world. and figure out what is the best method to do that for you and your players. You could essentially have this be the rumor in the town before they go into the Eastern Delta. You could have this be the vision they see when they get bit by a bug in the Eastern Delta or when they sleep in there. You could have this be, like you kind of mentioned, Morgan, the dialogue between the Plague Witch and the players before and during their fight. But I think, I'm trying to think which option I would choose. I'd probably want this to be fairly true, but everyone to think it is not true, but then find out how true it is.
Okay. So you think the players would be aware of it?
Mm-hmm. But not put like too much stock in it and then find out, oh my gosh, it's really true.
Like they go in there expecting something else. Like they're after the great beast of something or other. And then they go in and then they're like, oh, Plague Witch is real. Run. Mm-hmm. And she controls the beast. And it's one of her children grown up.
Yes.
But although I like the idea of not being aware of this rumor and the players coming across this kindly old woman and kindly old hunter man being like, oh, they're lovely and nice. And if they don't roll high enough perception, being like, oh, it's just everything's good. And she feeds them and then they go on their way and they continue on their journey. And later one of them gets sick and starts to cough and they're coughing up blood. And people are like, wait, what's going on here? And then they start hearing of these rumors of the Plague Witch out in the Delta Swamp. So, and that, you know, she's this terrible, evil thing. And they're like, wait, what? She did what now? And then they think back on sort of what was happening out there and the things that they saw, and they start to realize, oh no, what we saw was an illusion. What she's done has poisoned one of us. Now we have to go back out there and face the real Plague Witch and her real monster husband. And only through defeating her will this plague be quelled.
Lifted. It's interesting because not a ton of adventures circle back to things. And then, like, you really have a lot to do there. I mean, more... Yeah, it's not as common. I mean, don't get me wrong, it definitely happens, but some of them are just so linear. It's like, okay, we've done A, and now B, and now C. Oh, I have to go back to A? Interesting.
Mm. And you can see the ramifications of things, decisions that have been made throughout that journey. So yes, thank you, Friar Took, for that one.
Very much so. So for our third idea... I thought it would be interesting. Not interesting. I thought it would be necessary, apropos, relevant, if you will. Yes, very relevant. Since Morgan is here, to choose the idea that was done by Whipstash. Because he has... How would you say that first one? You were doing it quite well earlier.
Oh dear, was I? Bonde al-Mafek. Bonde al-Mafek.
Known more widely as Bainde the Blind. Oh, now it is relevant. And so the image was from the album Frost and Fire from the American heavy metal band Cirith Ungol, which is where Shelob's lair is located. So the fantasy gets real deep on this one.
Yep.
And the album debuted in 1965, so it's super crunchy, old school metal, really good. And all of their album art is ridiculously cool fantasy stuff. That is where that inspiration came from. And Morgan kind of talked about this image, but I'll let him describe it a little bit more because there's a lot going on.
There is. So you have this fantastic sickly green pallor across everything. From the clouds in the background to the top of this tower with a skull on the front of it with sharp teeth and horns coming out the side of it, all, of course, created out of what look like blocks of stone. And in the background is a pterodactyl with red eyes, and then you have what looks like Aquaman had a baby with He-Man, it seems like to me. And he's underwater. He's not really underwater, but that's kind of what he looks like with his hair streaming up to the side. And he's holding up the Castle Grayskull sword. And he's standing on the top of Castle Grayskull. Well, there we go. Well, that's what I would have done then.
Nice.
This is He-Man in his younger, more, you know, emo days.
I like this.
This is emo man. And glam rock / emo man with his wonderful tunic and cape, it looks like there. But of course... Whipstash is not me. Whipstash did not decide that this was He-Man / Aquaman. And so he's turned him into Bane Day the Blind, here seen rallying the southern forces after a victory against Grand Seer Wildenspear the Terrible.
And so despite the fact that the war continued for another 12 years, the victory at the Everlasting Keep was the turning point of the Great War. Bane Day was one of many heroes involved, but he was the
Sorry,
most
who?
Well-known. Gosh darn it. Bowen Day? See, how did you say it?
For the listeners who don't go to the forums, and how dare you, it's spelled B-O apostrophe U-N-D-E and then A-L, all lower caps, hyphen, capital M-A-H-F-E-K. So I gave it a Bowen Day al Mafek.
Bowen Day al Mafek. Yeah, I was just cheating and saying Bane Day. And then
oh, I know. That's, yeah. So, Fine. Yeah, so he was one of the many heroes involved in the war.
Yes, it was Bowen Day that convinced the elders that the battle, and thus the war, would not be won without the aid of the green dragon, Norrande.
This, of course, is despite the fact that Norrande had been the enemy of the civilizations of the West for generations. Bowen Day was able to not only hold court with her, nice, like it, but convince her to lend her aid against the Grand Seer. After the battle, Bowen Day stood on the highest parapet and let out the mightiest roar anyone had heard before or since. The bellow of Bane Day is one of the songs every bard learns in their second year at the academy, and I'm fairly certain images of a group of bards all with long, long hair and makeup painted on their faces, just strumming their sitars and their lyres like their life depended on it.
Yes.
And just... And then, yeah, sort of old school heavy metal bard songs.
I like it. With some jazz flute tossed into the mix from that one guy.
I love the idea of, you know, like they're playing, you know, this medieval tavern music, like ding, 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 you know, and but then the lead singer is like screamo metal.
Yes.
So they're playing like genuine medieval, like lyre music. And then the lead singer is just like, the bellow of Bane. And they're just in the background like, oh, I'm so sorry, guys. He does this. It'll be this one song and then he'll be finished. Just hang in there. You'll be fine. We'll get through it together.
Yes.
Long suffering.
I love it.
The amount of information that's in this that can take us through. And it's interesting because he doesn't go into how or when Bane Day lost his sight, whether he was born with no sight and somehow was able to become a hero in the war. And if this is Bane Day at the front here on the image, and I think it might be, the idea that he seems quite an adept fighter, you could potentially go, oh, well, okay, so because he was blind, he's now gone into politics, basically, and he's able to convince the elders, then able to convince the dragon, and, you know, working all these political angles. But he's also quite a strong and solid fighter from the looks of things.
Mm-hmm.
And it'd be very interesting sort of to know when the blindness happened, whether it was a part of the battle, whether it was part of his agreement with the Green Dragon, whether it was during the battle against the Grand Seer that the Seer blinded him, you know, as he cast down the Grand Seer.
It would make it a little bit more epic if it was even during this battle. Like, even blindness wouldn't stop him from being so successful and so integral to the battle at hand.
And it would give that roar at the end, the mightiest roar, you know, a lot more gravitas if it came from both the victory and also the despair of all the friends that had died, and also from his own pain and anguish at having been blinded during this final battle, in much the same way that, tying it back to Cirith Ungol, Aragorn, specifically the actor, Viggo Mortensen, when he kicks the orc helmet when they lost in the movie, when they lost the hobbits, and he kicks the orc helmet and then breaks down and cries, and they did take after take after take of this, and then on the final take, he kicked it and two of his toes broke. And he kind of just kept going. And that's the take they use. So when you watch that scene and when you hear the pain in his voice at having lost the halflings, part of that pain is because he's just broken two of his toes.
Yes, I love that story.
And so I feel like this is almost that same thing. Like, they're like, oh, his bellow was so amazing because they won and because it was triumphant and because of the friends that he lost. It's like, no, the bellow was so strong and powerful because he was standing on top of this parapet so everyone could hear him because his voice traveled, and also because he just had his eyes gouged out. Mm-hmm. This idea that sort of the reality of it, possibly if the players come across the green dragon, Norinde, after this fact, and the dragon sort of recounting this tale of, yes, I was at the battle, and you know, and they're like, oh, tell us about the bellow. It's like, well, he just had his eyes gouged out. What would you do? You'd cry about it, wouldn't you?
Yes.
But that's awesome. But also the placing, you know, the everlasting keep, and the idea of the battle being a turning point, even though the war continued, kind of like the Battle of Serenity Valley in Firefly, where it wasn't the final battle, but it was where the brown coats lost, where the fight went out of them, as it were. And so I think, you know, it's that kind of thing, but the opposite, you know, it's they won, but they then had to keep fighting. But this was kind of that turning point in the other direction.
Yes, I like it. I like all things that are this one, because there's so much imagery here that, I mean, we could keep going for quite some time. I mean, because you have the sword, like the story behind the sword, the horn that he has, how much we could talk about that.
Yeah.
Even the gauntlet that he's using to hold the sword looks different than, like, his other hand doesn't even look like it has a gauntlet. No. So does that mean he has to have the gauntlet to use the sword? So yeah, definitely check this one out. And there is a ton that you could pull from this. But as we do, Morgan and I are going to flesh one of these out right now.
On the fly. And so which one have we chosen to flesh out?
We have chosen 8, which is definitely one of the ones that's a little farther out there. And that was done by the artist Roger Dean. Go check his stuff out. It's really cool. He's been doing album covers since 1968, clear up into 2015.
I thought this one was interesting because it gives you sort of 2 or 3 different layers to play with. It's, just to give you a quick description, it's sort of a rocky foreground with a lot of what almost look like bonsai trees, sort of these sparse, rugged trees with a little bit of foliage on them. And then in this rocky foreground, there's a teeny tiny dude that I've only just noticed that I didn't even realize he was there. Mm-hmm. And he's got a little axe above his head there. He's just to the right of the tree.
Oh, I see him now. didn't even know he was there before then, but I see him now.
Neither did I. And then in the background, you have this fantastic collection of weird bluey gray. And I can't decide whether they're rock formations and then a city or whether it's a city, but it's some kind of strange, like metallic trees combined with rocks.
Yeah.
Really jagged and very different from what's going on in the foreground.
I was trying to figure out if they were built this way or if they were built into what was already there. Well, these are the things that we get to decide right here, right now.
Yes, as I try to find out if I can, because there looks like on one of those rocks to the left, there's some sort of scaling. And I'm sure it's not, but part of me wants to think maybe there's a dragon hiding in the rocks. Neil's just found a higher resolution version of this. And again, Google Roger Dean and you should be able to find it.
Yeah, now that Morgan and I are messing with a much higher resolution, there's 2 guys here and it looks like they're on the start of the path that leads all the way up to this giant spire that still, it looks like it's built into or out of a formation that was natural. And there's a bridge leading up to it.
Because it looks like it's stone, but then some of those fronds kind of look like trees, and maybe it's a petrified tree that they've carved into.
Ooh, I like it. What kind of people do we think live in this structure then?
I think very heavily organized, very regimented. The amount of time and effort that it took to do this, it's almost like if you describe to dwarves what elves were. And then the dwarves went, that sounds good, we'll do that. This is what you would end up with, which is like a thing that would be a travesty to elves.
Okay, so my idea, here we go. You ready?
Yep. Let's do this.
As always, I like to plug the ever-changing Book of Names because I use it, because it is amazing and I am not at naming things. So I will say that inside of this tower are the dwarves of Cradbrell. So C-R-A-D-B-R-E-L-L.
Cradbrell.
Yes. It's essentially exactly what you said. Like, they have gone up so far. Or what if we had something in their history that either brought them up or the land down? And this is like the dwarven structure that it's now exposed.
I think brought the land down, because I do like the idea of a giant petrified tree and then everything is washed away around it.
So if you look kind of, we have this tree here in the middle, and I've watched enough Bob Ross lately on Twitch that I assume that this is a happy tree. And just to the right of it, you can see the ocean. So this looks like a cliff that leads out into the ocean. What if there was some like crazy cataclysmic event that washed away everything but the structure that the dwarves had built?
Ooh, possibly. That could possibly be the, and I'm going to fail at pronouncing this, the Divuatic Ocean from Never, with his image of that skyship. I'm going to connect everything together. So this is, I'm going to do that with all of these wonderful ideas on the forums. I'm going to find a way to connect everything. Because, of course, all these ideas are theoretically all part of the same world, part of the same universe of Dayembe.
They are now. So, I've kind of fleshed out who's in the tower. Morgan, if we don't use Doug to have caused this, we've done ourselves the greatest of disservices.
We have. Well, I felt like what we could possibly do is combine, because Geeky DM has written a very interesting little thing here on the forums for number 6, which is the tower of the wizard Bellerith. And he's returned to his tower on the shores overlooking the Dayembe Sea, only to find a kraken, Doug, demolishing the cliffside to get to the magical items held in Bellerith's tower. And he musters a spell and casts it against his foe. What if Bellerith's tower and the kraken attacking it happened many, 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 many years ago, and this is actually Bellerith's tower, repurposed and taken over by
the dwarves of Cradbrell. Done. I'm in.
After having been evicted from their home.
Yes. I like it. I like it a lot. Perfect. Oh, Doug. Hashtag, oh, Doug.
Hashtag, Dougspiracy.
Nice. Okay, so now we're 100% sure how the tower showed up.
Yeah, I still think it was a tree that became petrified, and then the land around it eroded, and the wizard Bellerith may have been involved in that somehow. But then Doug turned up and tried to wreck things. The wizard, he seems to have gone, and now many, many moons later, the dwarves have turned up, and they've carved into it, and they've made it their own. And then who are these guys out the front? Because they're not dwarves. They do not look like dwarves.
Mm-mm.
So where do they come from? And they don't look like barbarians, so I don't think they're not Ragnar's men.
Mm-mm.
Could they perhaps come from the original home of the Plague Witch before she went into the... Because we don't know where that is. We know that it's near the swamp. So she lived in a land on the border of the Delta Swamps, but I don't believe that land was ever named. Could these fellows be emissaries from that land, set to watch the border between their land and the land of the dwarves?
Yes. I like it, because they do look kind of scout-ish.
Hmm.
Armor, but not necessarily like super heavy armor.
No.
They are the emissaries. But you said emissaries, though, right?
Well, quite possibly. I mean, it depends. Are they just stopping for a break in the shade on their travels? Because they are in the shade. They've put themselves in the shade. Or are they doing that to hide themselves from the dwarves? In which case, they're not emissaries. They're forward scouts for an invading army.
I think emissaries is more fun because you have so many people walking this path and walking up to the tower itself, because it looks like 10 people walking up that don't include these two. Cool. Well, that'll do it.
But with that, that's another superset out of the way. Celeste, if people wanted to get a hold of us and tell us how they are covering it all, how would they do it?
Yeah, you can always reach out to us via email at dmnastics@gmail.com. And of course, talk to us on Twitter @dmnastics.
As always, DMnastics is a proud member of the Block Party Podcast Network. You can check out all the other shows at blockpartypodcastnetwork.com.
And thank you to the bards over at Bombarded for our intro and outro music. You can find out more about Bombarded at bombardedcast.com.
But with that, we'll turn out the lights and head out of the gym. But before we go, I want to implore you, the listener, to join up on the forums, the Discord, wherever you can find us, and take part in these challenges, exercises, and other amazing conversations being had.
To do that, head over to dungeonmasterblock.freeforums.net and try some DMnastics so your players don't ask, do you even lift?